This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Pagan Ampike Pagan, and today I'm going to be talking about this.
Monopoly's been good to me. Very, very good.
Monopoly. It ruins families, it tears friendships apart, it is played by everyone. From Jerry Hall to Mick Jagger to Carmela and Tony Soprano, in 1959, Fidel Castro ordered the destruction of every Monopoly set in Cuba. And everything you know about the game is wrong. For starters, the game we call Monopoly was actually invented as an object lesson in the evils of capitalism. Clearly, it didn't work. Who knows how many future raiders and real estate moguls were inculcated with greed at a tender age after playing the game Monopoly. What's more, for decades, the official story slipped into every Monopoly box was that Charles Darrow, an unemployed salesman, had a sudden light bulb moment about a game to amuse his poor family during the Depression, and he sold it to Parker Brothers in 1935 and lived lavishly ever after on the proceeds. This is also wrong. The truth, as you can probably imagine, is a lot more complex. In a brilliant attempt at tracing this truth, journalist and author Mary Pallon has written a brilliant book.
Sure, my name is Mary Pallon. I'm the author of The Monopolist.
It's called The Monopolists, and it is this strange and at times tragic story of the evolution of the world's favorite board game. So, Mary, in a nutshell, tell us the story of Charles Darrow, Lizzie Maggie, and this board game heist.
Sure. So for years, the story of Monopoly's invention that I believed, and most people believed, was that a man invented it, Charles Darrow, during the height of the Great Depression here in the United States. The only problem with that story is it's not exactly true. And in fact, the game originates with a left-wing woman, her name was Lizzie McGee, who received a patent for her landlord's game in 1904, so well before the Great Depression. The game was enjoyed as a folk game. It was pretty popular, especially among a constellation of left-wing politicos. And then it's a version of this game that sold the Parker Brothers, and this kind of crazy legal battle in the 70s is what accidentally unearthed the whole story, and that Darrow didn't actually put the game.
So how did you first come upon this crazy story? Because I, like everyone else, believed what I saw in that little write-up in every Monopoly box.
Yeah, so it came to me totally by accident. In 2009, I was working at the Wall Street Journal. I was covering a lot of business topics. And as you might remember, in 2009, that's a pretty grim year to be writing about business. And I was going to mention that Monopoly had been invented during the Great Depression in passing in a story. I've always loved games and puzzles, and I thought it'd become an interesting reference. And I was looking, and the story wasn't adding up, and I was totally frustrated, and I felt like an idiot, and I was like, God, I can't get the sentence in my story about board games right. We're here writing about, you know, investment banks and derivatives and all these complicated things. And I had heard about Ralph and his lawsuit, and I dropped him a line on a whim and said, hey, I know this sounds crazy, but I'm trying to find out the true story about Monopoly. And he immediately got back to me and said, oh, I know all about it, and then just started telling me, you know, his own personal story, his own lawsuit, and then how that kind of hatched open the true history. So I originally wrote the story for the Journal in 2009, and I just had so many more questions. So I kept reporting out what ultimately became the book proposal and then the book.
Because the book keeps unraveling. It's fantastic. Every chapter kind of takes you down a different road, which in many ways could tell its own story and become its own book.
Yeah. So it, I didn't know what I was getting into, to be totally honest. And I wasn't one of those writers who dreamed of doing a book. I was really happy and still very happy doing newspaper or magazine teacher work. I find it really gratifying and fun. And there's a lot of, lots to be said for kind of the quicker pace of it. But this story, you know, the more and more I looked into it, and I wasn't sure if it was a book, if it was a magazine piece, if it was a screenplay, what it was going to be. It became clear that there was just a lot of historical threads. And I think that the book format lets you tell those different stories in more depth. Because it was history, I felt like it needed that kind of attention. And structuring the book was by far, I think, one of the greatest challenges because the more I looked into Lizzie and kind of trying to find out as much as I could about her, seeing that the clock wound back, not just to 1904 when she got her patents, but her father and his involvement with Abraham Lincoln before the Civil War, It just became, and then, you know, of course, the book has very contemporary implications for game designers, inventors, anybody who's interested in the nature of innovation. So I was looking, and I was totally, not sure how to tackle it, but I think the book ended up being the right formula. And it was very stressful at times to do because I didn't know if I was going to finish. I didn't know what kind of form it was going to take. You don't know if it's going to be successful or not. So now I'm on the other side kind of looking at it, and I'm so thrilled with the reaction. But it was definitely, it was absolutely a journey as an author for sure.
No, the reaction's been great because I like yourself, like me, so many people when reading this book seem to have that exact same shock and awe as to, have I been duped my entire life?
Right. And I think that one of the things that is one of the bigger takeaways for the book is that in researching it, it became really fascinating to see who was telling the right story, who was telling the wrong one. And here we are, it was 2009, some years ago, but still today we're in this era where we think we can Google everything. And as much as digital tools really, really helped in huge ways in reporting this book, there was so much that was wrong and repeated wrong. And it really made me, as a journalist, you're kind of wired to be cynical anyway, but it really did make me think of all the different things in the world. You know, I have a curse where I look at like a teapot or a mixer or, you know, the chair, and I wonder like, who invented that? Who got credit? Who got paid? And how did that come to be? What was the trial and error? And I think as we kind of walk through the world, and we often don't question how things got there, the histories or whatever came before. And something even as simple as Monopoly ended up having this kind of crazy backstory. And so I now look at everything, you know, differently. And I felt like, this came up in another conversation I was having, you know, in the last few years, people ask, like, why have you spent all this time writing a book about Monopoly, of all things? And especially because a lot of the work I tend to do is more investigative, and I focus on kind of more hard-hitting topics, or try to. And I feel like if we can't get the story of Monopoly right, what hope is there for anything else? And I'm really pleased that it was finished. I feel like there's a lot here that has nothing to do with board games that hopefully people find interesting.
I'm speaking to journalist and author Mary Pallon about the hidden history behind the board game Monopoly. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. This is the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Pagan Ampike Pagan, and I'm speaking today to author Mary Pallon about the invention and evolution of the board game Monopoly. It turns out that the story of Monopoly wasn't that nice, clean, well-structured example of the Eureka School of American industrial legend. It just didn't happen that way. It is instead an age-old tale of the big corporation trampling all over the little guy. It seems to be this really classic story, and one we keep hearing, right? Philo Farnsworth, Thomas Edison, Nikola Tesla, the publishers of Action Comics buying Superman for $130, where the big corporation takes advantage of and eventually crushes the little guy, right? It's this narrative that keeps happening.
Right, yeah, and I think that history's full of legitimacies and these people that kind of quietly chip away at the world. And actually, when I originally wrote her story, I had to go back and kind of re-report it because I felt like I was missing a context for what it meant for a woman to walk into a patent office in 1904. And at that time, the United States women couldn't vote. Only a few years before, this came up in an op-ed I'd done for The Guardian, tied to the book and the monopolist release in the UK. There were people who actually said, like, women shouldn't bother applying for a patent because it will weaken the likelihood that they'll get a patent approval. And more I'm hearing from people that are totally marginalized when it comes to getting credit for things, whether it's because of, you know, socioeconomic status or race or gender or what have you. It's almost now not as surprising to me as I think it was when I first started hearing about Lizzie McGee from Ralph. And I think there's a lot of that. And I think the more contemporary version, too, is if you look at, like, The Social Network, too. I mean, sometimes these questions and answering who was there first can get really, really messy. And I think innovation in general and how good ideas get made is often a collaborative effort, and that gets messy too. So, especially when there's billions of dollars on the line.
And I'm glad you brought that up about, I guess, a woman in 1903, you know, walking into the patent office. Talk to me about Lizzie McGee, because she sounds like this absolutely remarkable woman, like this 21st century woman.
Right. She was really fascinating. I didn't know much about her when I started, and I almost wanted to write like her own, she didn't really have any public biographies or anything, and researching someone who's famous for being obscure, right? Who died in 1948 with no children. was very, very, very challenging. But she was an outspoken, politically minded woman. Her landlord's game was designed as a teaching tool to show the principles of Henry George, who was this advocate for something called a single tax. And I kind of think of Henry George and his followers, who sometimes called themselves anti-monopolists, as a reaction to the tremendous amount of wealth that was being created in the United States at the time. I mean, you had just a few people who had become rich in a way that hadn't really happened quite before, you know, Carnegie, Rockefeller, et cetera. And she really felt like this could be a way to communicate her ideas. She also performed in theater. She wrote short stories. She wrote poems. Because her father, James McGee, had these links to Abraham Lincoln, he was also an influential newspaper owner. So she had a lot of exposure to politics and journalism at a really young age, because that was a question I had going into this, because she had so much headwind and she was so unusual. When she received her patent for the landlord's game in 1904, fewer than 1% of patents were coming from women. So any way you slice it, she was pretty exceptional.
So why do you suppose it's taken this long to tell her story? Why has that Parker brother myth endured for so long?
Well, what's fascinating about that to me is that, technically speaking, the story has been out there for a long time. I mean, Ralph Ansbach's lawsuit, which unearthed this, you know, started in the early 70s, and he was talking pretty extensively about the origins of the game to various news outlets, some of which were very large and prestigious. In the case, you know, he ultimately won in 1983. So the story has been out there for, you know, quite some time. But I think that the Darrow story, it's amazing to me, because the story that we could go into our basement and innovate and create something, it's so beautiful. It's so romantic. And who doesn't want to think that they too could go and gin up something that will make them and their family, you know, well off, and especially during a dark time like the Great Depression. Even if it's not true, I think there's something very magnetic about that for people. So that's another, you know, you were talking about Lizzie McGee. Like, I think that's another obstacle she had, which is that the story of Darrow is really captivating. But, you know, unfortunately, it's just not what happened. And I think there's something to be said for us, you know, as readers, as consumers of media, like, why is it that we fall in love with these things? It's something I found myself very, very interested by as well.
And you're absolutely right, because I couldn't pick out the antagonist of this tale. I mean, I felt a great deal for Lizzie McGee and Ralph Ansbach, but between Darrow and Parker Brothers, I kept moving from dislike to begrudging admiration and back to dislike again.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I think that, you know, it's interesting. I think it's really easy to write a book about black and white and good versus evil. But for me, this story wasn't that. In fact, it was actually, I think there's a lot of gray. And I was very curious about what motivated Parker Brothers, what motivated Darrow. And I think that they're human beings, and you want to treat people like human beings and try to get as true and complex of a portrait of somebody or a company as you possibly can, and understand where they're coming from as well. And I think particularly if you look at the Parker history, and George Parker's own biography, I mean, there's some parts that are just absolutely tragic. I mean, he lost two sons at a very young age in very tragic ways, one in a plane crash, one of disease. He's left without an heir apparent to his family firm that he'd built as a teenager. You know, the board game industry, which he's very much a pioneer in, becomes more competitive. So he almost becomes his own enemy, because he entices so many other people to join the profession. So I think that understanding that, you know, you don't want to do a disservice. So there's a journalistic side, which is you want to be fair, but there's also the storytelling side, which is, I think that the truth is there was a lot of ambiguity, and it is really complicated the more deeply you look at it. So I tried as best as I could to tell the story at the fairest way I could. But like any story, you know, it's fascinating to see what people's reactions have been. And I think the fact that they're kind of all over the place in terms of who they root for makes me happy, because I think that you want the story to be the facts and let people kind of infer what they choose from that.
I'm speaking to Mary Pallon. She is the author of the book, The Monopolists, this clever, engaging, finely crafted, endlessly surprising and scholarly work about the history and evolution of the world's favorite board game, Monopoly. After the news, I'll ask her about why Monopoly, above all else, has endured for the better part of a century. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Pagan, I'm PK Pagan. In 1902, a stenographer at the Washington, D.C. Daily Letter office designed a board game she christened the Landlord's Game. Her name was Elizabeth McGee. She was 36, and she was in search of a new way to teach America about the political theorist Henry George's single tax proposal. That game, by Lizzie McGee, across decades of plagiarism and corporate wrangling, would eventually manifest itself as what we now know and love as Monopoly. I'm speaking today to Mary Pallon. Her brilliant book, The Monopolists, is the definitive read when it comes to the history of this much-loved board game. Yeah, there is this interesting notion that I took away from the book, that somehow this idea of Monopoly across so many individuals simply existed, that it stems from some innate dissatisfaction and distrust of authority and our need to stand up against inequality?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of takeaways from it. And I think that what's striking to me, too, is how outspoken a lot of these characters are. And if you look at the Ralph story, so he's this economist. He makes this game called Anti-Monopoly, which from its very origins is very rooted in his wanting to, you know, send a political message. And there were so many parts in his lawsuit where I think a lot of people would have made other decisions, like that point where he refuses a pretty significant settlement and kind of goes up against his lawyer at the time. I think that there are a lot of people who would have taken the settlement. And then as a result, it's really unlikely that he would have been able to talk about the game's origin. So I think that is kind of a running theme. And with Ralph, what's also strange is that when he creates Anti-Monopoly and kind of embarks on this legal battle, he has no idea that by making this game, he's actually bringing it back to its kind of left-wing progressive roots and what Lizzie McGee was trying to do with the Landlord Game. So the irony switch gets flipped many, many times in the story.
Anti-Monopoly is so much closer to the Landlord's Game. Monopoly somehow got subverted into something completely different.
Right, which is fascinating. And when Lizzie McGee makes her her Landlord's Game, she actually makes two rule sets. She makes a monopolist rule set and an anti-monopolist rule set. And it's pretty quickly the monopolist rule set that takes on as a folk game. So you can read into that, you know, whatever you want in human nature on that one. But it's funny to me that when given these two options, people veered towards the one where they're clobbering each other. But it's not long before the political message that she was trying to get across becomes really muddled. You know, within a few years almost, it seems like the game kind of forks off. And people see it as a teaching tool for the evils of Monopoly, and there's hints of, you know, single tax theory and Henry George in there, but it's not nearly as explicit as maybe what she had originally set out to teach.
There's this great duality, right? Because on one part of the American narrative, there is this notion that, you know, you stand up against authority, you don't have to pay taxes for the things you create. But then, of course, on the other hand, it's this, hey, it's the land of the free, I should be able to make as much money as humanly possible.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that's so funny to me about that is that, you know, it's been really funny to hear people tell their own personal Monopoly stories, and a lot of them are really negative, and a lot of people play Monopoly by the wrong rules and things, but when you ask people, like, whether Monopoly actually teaches people about the way the world works or not, you get all these really interesting answers, so I think it's interesting how it all kind of ended up today, and I remember when I was at the Journal, Occupy Wall Street was a big story, and you would go down to Zuccotti Park here in New York, and I would see, like, the Mr. Monopoly iconography and think, oh, my gosh, you know, here we are, like, all this time later, and finally it's come full circle. So there you have it. It only took a century or so.
Monopoly is awful. There is something so deceptive about the game, this sinister side that's hidden behind this notion of family fun. I can't tell you how many nasty, nasty games of Monopoly I've had.
Yeah, you're not alone on that one. That's for darn sure.
So why do you suppose Monopoly, of all things, has lasted the better part of 113 years? I mean, what is its appeal?
Gosh, that's a fantastic question. And I'm not sure if I know the answer, to be honest. I think Monopoly, first of all, it's a really unusual game in that we learn it from our families. We have it passed down to us. It's not like most people sit and, you know, open up a Monopoly rule set and you know, have it taught to them that way. So it's a really unusual game in that it's multi-generational. But I think that's also part of the success, is that at this point, when you talk to people in Monopoly, you almost never hear them say things like, you know, relating to the technical gameplay. It's almost always about their memories tied to the game. It has nothing to do with the game itself. And so we project a lot on the Monopoly, right? It's not, so for example, my family, it's not so much about how we play. It's about Christmas and it's about Thanksgiving and it's about holidays and it's about time we spend together and it's about, you know, the way we differ and get along. And so it's, I think it's more about the memories you associate with it, which I know sounds really cheesy, but I think that's absolutely true.
So you've been working on this book for ages. Do you still play Monopoly? And if you do, what token do you play with?
Oh, that's so funny. I do play Monopoly, and actually compared to the act of you know, writing a book, getting away from your computer screen and playing a game is always a really nice break. When I was a kid, I played as a dog. Now I play as a thimble, but I feel like I should switch to the iron because it got voted out, and I think it needs like a vote of solidarity.
That was Mary Pallon. You can find her book, The Monopolists, at all good bookstores. If you missed any part of this program, you can download the podcast, as always, on bfm.my. You've been listening to The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.